very densely underbrushed wood along paths that went through it. And at one point, I was walking behind one of the veterans, and somebody else stepped on a stick that broke with a reasonably large, but by no means awesome, snap. And the next thing I knew, the fellow walking ahead of me was about 15 feet off the trail on his stomach, having plowed a hole through I don't know how much poison oak, prone, looking back up at the trail. The snap had been something that meant nothing to me. It was what happened when you went walking in the woods. And I didn't know what I was looking at then, but what I was looking at was, I think, has the term, medical term, hypervigilance, or at least is an aspect of it, and is one of the symptoms which, depending on how a person who has it feels about it, is definitely a symptom of what has now become recognized relatedly by the medical and psychiatric community as a particular form of disorder called post-traumatic stress. At any rate, the next speaker is a fellow I was privileged to meet by a circuitous route involving the fact that this friend of ours from 25 years ago came back from Canada to go into a program for the treatment of PTSD in a major, perhaps the major, Veterans Administration facility in the United States, which happens to be located in Menlo Park, about 5 minutes walk away from our house. He came to visit us. We were delighted to see him, and through him we met some remarkable people. And the first of those is David Powell. David?
Thank you. Hello. I am not used to public speaking, so this is going to be a wing and a prayer. I do own the data that I'm going to share with you, so it's a little personal, and I'm going to get through it as best I can. It means a lot to me that you all hear it, so that you may get a better appreciation for what PTSD is at all. That is my aim. Dr. Gerbode, Mr. French, and the other people at the Institute invited me to come and speak here to this group of helping eagles. Thank you all for having me. My name's David Powell. I was born in Pasadena, California. It's the home of the Rose Parade. I was the only child for the first 9 years of my life. Then along came a gorgeous sister, and that's the end of my parents' couplings. I was taught by my parents, relatives, teachers, and advisors, and the media that patriotism was a virtue. Patriots were respected and revered. Patriots who fought for their country, especially in combat, were especially revered and well thought of. That was programmed into me, and I think it remains there. I hope to give you some examples later of how that was invalidated, but I still own it. I served in the United States Marine Corps in Vietnam in two topographical areas. One was Chu Lai, and the other was Da Nang. I was there from October of 1966 through November of 1967. I was a combat Marine. My military weapons expertise included the 106 recoilless rifle, which is a great big cannon, flamethrowers, ordnance, which is mines and explosives, my favorite weapon, which was the 3.5 rocket launcher, which was a little bit larger than what was in Korea in the Second World War, known as a bazooka. I also knew how to fire the 45 caliber pistol and the M14 and M16 rifles. It's interesting, the only thing I didn't actually use, in Vietnam was the 106 recoilless rifle. A little difficult to carry, and it was way in the rear, and they didn't have those sorts of plans for me. I participated in 7 large-scale combat operations. A large-scale combat operation typically involved 500 men or more. I went on many squad, platoon, and company-sized patrols, and since my weapon was a rocket launcher, they weren't real popular at nighttime ambushes because they flash and they do make a lot of noise, so I didn't have to go on more than a dozen of those. I'm quite happy I didn't have to. Don't like night. The happy, carefree Marine before you now wasn't always like this. I am a repairing PTSD victim. Until 6 months ago, I, and I'd submit many others, unsuccessfully struggled with the PTSD problems that I had. PTSD, like Gerald said, is an acronym for what the American Psychiatric Association called the readjustment problems of Vietnam veterans. It stands for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Psychiatrists, psychologists, and other people who work with the likes of me, particularly combat veterans, are in agreement that this disorder is a delayed reaction to stresses and traumas that we'd experienced. Just some data, many if not all of the veterans I know take exception to the term delayed. It is true that the traumatic incidents and stresses were quite interesting. They were up close and personal. However, the delay was consciously applied. I applied it, Peter applied it, and anybody who was there that has it or thinks they have it or denies that they have it recognize that it was not some sort of cooking time that goes on. You don't get a piece of PTSD and then pretty soon it matures and grows and then you finally have it. It's more that you do it to yourself until it hurts too bad. I'll have to shed more light on this later. There remains considerable confusion about PTSD in the mental health agencies, also in the veterans and the public at large. For instance, have you thought, said, or heard such remarks as, I'll admit that war can cause problems for people that were there, knowing that they certainly must have gone through some sad things. But this PTSD problem should have come to light years ago. How come after all this time, this problem suddenly appears? I've heard that. Or, we have been in wars before, World War II and Korea, for example. War and combat is the same, no matter when or where it occurs. Why is the Vietnam War so different from other wars that its veteran alone suffers from PTSD? Or another interesting one, isn't PTSD just a fancy new way to say shell shock? That's been talked about since World War I. Shell shock's a term that was coined around World War I, and they thought it was actual physical damage caused to the combat veteran. They thought that the air pressure from the exploding shells was making them unusual. That may have. Or another quote that I enjoy. Sure, we should have been more understanding and sympathetic when our servicemen came back from Vietnam. But just look how we've responded lately. We've had numerous welcome home events, giving them hugs, saying, gee, it's nice, thanks, we're sorry we said what we said, but, you know, please forgive us now. What do they want now? It's almost like a frustration. In order to gain a grasp of the magnitude of the problem Vietnam veterans face, I'd like to give you some data and some information. One issue, far too many people, veteran and non-veteran alike, who complain that the Vietnam veteran should have come forward years ago if he really was disturbed and unable to readjust to life after Vietnam. I ask you, who would he have turned to all those years ago? There's precious little help available today. That's wet palm. Further, think of the number of misses the Vietnam veteran with PTSD would have encountered along the way. Again, I submit that far too few understand what PTSD is, let alone profess that they can help now, let alone then. Another issue that's interesting is some raw, simple statistics. I'm sure you're all familiar with the wall in Washington, D.C. It's the memorial to the Vietnam veteran who perished. That wall has 58,000 names on it. What's not on that wall are people who died later as a result of their wounds. And significantly, what is not on that wall since the end of the conflict are the names of the people who died in suicides or single car automobile accidents, which is kind of interesting if you think that a bridge embankment jumps up in front of your car. If we were to include those people, we would have to make room for 61,000 more names. That speaks to PTSD. These numbers continue to grow, by the way. More statistics. I recently spent some time helping organize a help-a-thon for Coffee TV 20. It was a six-hour program for the homeless in the Bay Area, trying to raise money. I was invited because I'm a Vietnam veteran and I have an interest in having my data shared out there. Don't forget us. The statistic that came out of the help-a-thon, or what I brought and told them and they had it verified, was that 39% of the homeless in San Francisco Bay Area are veterans, predominantly Vietnam veterans. They're not there out of choice. I submit they're there out of being upset. In prisons, between 15 and 20% of the inmates are Vietnam veterans, most of whom had no prior criminal record. I want to tell you some things about my personal experiences in Vietnam. I do that, or I'm about to do that, so that you can get it from a, a first-hand, up-close report from a combat veteran, as opposed to a supply clerk who was real upset when he heard that somebody else got shot in a truck 5 miles away and claims to have PTSD. Also want to do it because I'd like you to try and participate in it and get a feeling for it, the experiences, and see if they aren't traumatic to you as well. I submit that in the 13 months, some of my experiences were traumatic, but you please judge for yourselves. As you listen, and hopefully that's what you will be doing, try to project yourself into the situations and events. By the way, listening is strictly voluntary, so if you don't want to do it, don't feel you have to. Up until 6 months ago, I had the opinion that no one wanted nor cared to hear what I had to say, so I'm not going to be offended. If your neighbor snores, would you just please bump him a little bit? Before I get into it, let me explain a little bit about how I ended up in the Marine Corps. If you don't know, that's a strictly voluntary thing to do to yourself. I do want you to know that it wasn't a career move on my part. 1966 is the year. 24 years was how long I was on Earth this time. And I was a happily married man. Had been married 3.5 years. Early in that year, I thought I'd be drafted into the Army. It wasn't something I just decided to think. They sent me little papers that said, we found you. I was responsibly employed, had a bright, successful life, stretching out in front of my innocent eyes then. Kind of caught, like most people were at that time, with the draft and the buildup of Vietnam. And it was increasingly presumed that if you were 18 or older and you were healthy enough to pass their minimal tests, that you'd go. My employer thought that too. Essentially told me that there was no point in planning my career, nor giving me any raises or promotions. We'd take care of all that when I got back. Consequently, I was motivated to go into the military service and get back as soon as possible. That does kind of sound like a career move, doesn't it? When it finally settled in on me that I was going to go, I'd enlisted and signed up. I had my interest piqued about fulfilling my patriotism requirement as I viewed it. Marine Corps wasn't the only place I went. In fact, that was the last place I went. I talked to every Armed Forces recruiter going, ended up with, can't go now, it's a 4-year enlistment, we're full. Why don't you just wait till you get drafted? And I've got this career going. Bumped up against the Navy, and next door is a Marine Corps recruiter in dress blues waving a flag, and he's, how do you spell your last name? And you can go tomorrow. So I went over and spent some time with him, about a half hour. I said, I'm a data processor, which was my vocation. He says, well, if you go in, we have computers. We'll most likely put you to work on the computer. You've all been to a recruiter. Interesting that didn't happen. Just as an aside, my data processing background was conspicuously missing from my service record book, which says who you are and what you know and don't know. I can't fault the recruiter, but I could sure have a bad attitude on the drill instructor that had my first information. After recruit training, which is turning you from a civilian into a basic person. Their opinion, not mine. That was followed by advanced infantry training, where they teach you how to run and shoot instead of stand and shoot. Specialized weapons training, which is where I got my military specialty, which is how do you load and shoot a flamethrower, how do you aim and fire a rocket, how do you set mines and booby traps, how do you take them away if you find one of theirs. Then I had a 20-day leave and found myself facing that tour. The date was October 20th, 1966. I knew then precisely when I'd get back. It was going to be November 10th, the Marine Corps birthday, 1967. Little more data. Every branch of the service except the Marine Corps had a 12-month tour. The Marine Corps, probably because they like to one-up everybody else, set it out at 13 months. Nonetheless, it was a fixed tour. Significantly, no other war ever had such a fixed tour of duty. That has some relevance too later. Here's how I got there. Got on a plane and was flown to Chiu Lai, which is down below Da Nang, well down below the DMZ. But it was one of the initial places where the Marine Corps pulled its amphibious assault in 65 and began in earnest saving the Vietnamese people. I got on the ground in Chiu Lai and traveled for 3 days on truck, boat, and by foot till I finally got to my company, which was Delta Company, deep in the countryside. It was night. I was shown the tent that I'd called home for the first 7 months of my tour there, and was by myself. I didn't go with a whole group of people arriving as a fresh wave of things. That was how things were in Vietnam. People went off and came in and went off and came in on a daily basis, which is part of that 13-month tour. Nobody introduced themselves. It wasn't a real social setting, but forgive them for that. Somebody should have said something, I think. It had been raining all the 3 days I was traveling, so I was good and soaking wet. I found an empty cot and I put my stuff down, rifle, sea bag, and change of clothes. I don't like mosquitoes a lot. Well, they had lots of them over there, and my first night was absolutely maddening. Wet, alone, dark, in Vietnam, 13 months to go, and mosquitoes all over me. I was so mad I could scream at the top of my lungs. In the morning, I woke up covered with mosquito bites, having not slept the entire evening. I dreaded the coming night, and each night thereafter, all the time I was there. And I still don't like mosquitoes. When morning light came, everybody was moving around the tent. I introduced myself to the people there and finally found a bunk that I could call my own. Started to get situated permanently. My squad leader, who lived in another tent, came by and introduced himself, told me what the daily pattern was going to be, all just more of the same, and then headed back to his tent. I spent that first day at the company putting my things in order, laying out a little nest so I felt comfortable, loading my rifle magazines with stolen bullets, and generally adapting physically to the environment. I had to steal the bullets because they didn't give me any when I got to Chiu Lai, nor all the time I was traveling to my company, which, as you remember, was a 3-day trip. I didn't want to go unarmed any longer, so I started taking care of myself right then. That night, I was sleeping, and a guy came in and woke me up. What's going on? Well, it's your turn to stand watch. What's watch? I said. He says, well, you go out here. We've got a little place where we all go from this tent, and we watch out for the Vietnamese people who might come up and surprise us while the other guys are sleeping, and we don't want that happening. Watches last 3 hours. They rotated every evening, which meant you didn't always go from 8 to 11. You went from 5 to 8, and then the next night, 8 to 11, and so on, through all of the darkness. You stand watch alone. I developed a real appreciation for dark. Hated it. Can't see anything. And a growing fondness for rain. It rained a lot there. The worst watch for me was the last one. It was supposed to last 3 hours, but when does it end? I never could figure out when the vigil would end. The day became one long string of watching for the guy to come get you. Only now, after all these years, I can see an end to that vigil. As another aside, until recently, I hadn't slept through the night since my third or fourth night in Vietnam. That was about October 24th, 1966, so my sleep patterns are not to be exampled. That was my first day. My second day in country was also my first patrol. A patrol is a gathering of people with military skills, machine gunners, rockets, as I was, riflemen and the like. Squad size is usually 11 men. You're told someplace to go look for them or surprise them if you catch them sleeping or getting ready to do something to you, and come back. Now, you're supposed to keep yourself safe all the way along, and if you find them before you get to the objective, that's fine. Go ahead and shoot at them. If If you don't find them on the way and you don't find them when you get there, bear in mind that you're going to be looking for them on the way back, because they'll be looking for you on the way back. That is a patrol. This is now my second day, and I'm walking out there like Bambi, not knowing what to do with all my special training, and we got shot at. What did I do? I just froze. The first bullet froze me. Luckily, a guy kicked me, and then it brought my attention that I shouldn't just stand there and let them try twice. Even now, this part of it hasn't gone away from me. Every time I hear a sharp crack, like Gerald has mentioned that he experienced in Santa Cruz, I get a real short neck. I bend over. Sometimes I'll go down, and adrenaline just races through my body. That's, I think, my opinion. It's hypervigilance. It's not something I was born with, but I got it right after that first patrol, that attention to detail. This is also typical. We didn't shoot back at them. We didn't know where the shots came from. Hardly ever did, unless it was more than just snipers shooting at you, which was, remembering it was a guerrilla war, you could rake, rake, shoot, rake, rake, which they did, and we shot, and so it went. I was frightened when I knew that I had frozen. I was full of doubt, self-conscious, and I was feeling very much alone. It seemed like I was the only one in this condition. I certainly didn't take an inventory at the time, so I still think that every one of us there on that patrol was as interested in that patrol and being shot at as I, but it seemed like I was the only one in that condition. After that patrol, I wanted desperately to go home. That was not to be the case, though. I went on 150 more. I mentioned before, perhaps, that in combat, my primary weapon was the 3.5 rocket launcher. That's a big round tube, about 4.5 or 5 feet in length. It has a pistol area that you hold, and you have a little thing that you look out. Presumably, that's the direction the rocket's going to go. And a squeezing mechanism that ignites the rocket inside the tube. Again, it's like a bazooka, shoots rockets out. Weighed about 7 or 8 pounds with a rocket inside, and that's how we carried the weapon. The gunner who had the rocket launcher itself always carried one round in the rocket launcher, slung over the shoulder with the hand holding the rocket in the tube. Then we had an assistant gunner so that we had more than one shot while we were out there, and he usually carried 3 or more rounds, rocket rounds. The team was called Rockets. I don't know where they got the name. My squad leader, who had been in Vietnam 4 or 5 months before my arrival, was a quiet, unassuming black man named Jones. Jones was concerned about Jones getting home in one piece and alive. Everybody had the same opinion. On my fourth day, we're about October 28th now, we went on a company-sized search and destroy mission. I don't think that the government's popular with the term search and destroy, but that's what it was then. That's what it was called then. I believe it's called something else now. These missions, company-sized and larger, I mentioned, was in excess of 250 people in a company to 500 men on major operations. This was a company size. They lasted 4 or 5 days, up to 30 days and longer. We lived in the countryside known as the bush. How we began those operations was to carry as much ammunition and change of clothes, if you considered doing that, which most often you didn't. You just slept in what you had. And it weighed, especially if it got wet, so we didn't much bother with styling. We were just interested in going and coming. We also carried about 5 days' worth of meals in our packs, sea rations, and we'd strip them out of the boxes and carry just essentially what we could eat. Again, more concerned with the weight than the nutritional roundness of your meals. When we ran out of them, typically we ran out of about 5 days, we'd eaten everything in sight. We'd get resupplied. They'd either send it via helicopter or just fly over and airdrop this stuff onto us. In either case, the Vietnamese citizens would know that there was a bunch of us out there, at least, and where we were going to go to get our food. So the getting of the food was nice in one respect, but it was stimulating in the other. We're back on the company size search and destroy now. And we left at 3 a.m., pitch black and raining. Nothing much happened the first day. Usually when we went out on that size operation, we were going well out of our topical area into uncharted grounds, if you will, or places where we suspected that there were Vietnamese citizens building up their strength to have a little run at us. On the second day of the mission, this is in mid-afternoon, the front of the column came under heavy continuous fire from the citizenry. The call rockets came down the line, and that meant that Jones and I would run up and try and do something to speed their departure. Anytime any of us came under fire, everybody got down low as possible. But in order to come responding to the call rockets, you have to get up and run to wherever the point of attack is. And that's precisely what we did. Got to the front of the line, and Jones says, they're coming from over there. Shoot a white phosphorus round. If it gets close enough, it'll hit them and burn them. And in any event, the white phosphorus round will throw up enough white smoke so that we can call artillery in. I did that. I took aim and squeezed the trigger, and all I heard was right next to my ear. Nothing happened with the rocket launcher. I looked at Jones. Jones looked at me, and his eyes were full of fear. He yelled, "Hang fire," which meant that the rocket in the rocket launcher was armed, caught in the launcher, and ready to explode at any minute. I mentioned that Jones was interested in getting himself back. Here's a point to that. Jones, along with every man close enough to hear, ran away from me, leaving me with my own personal bomb inches from my head. I thought I was going to die. I was left frozen in place, alone with this utterly horrible thought for minutes. Sometime later, and then only after his fears had diminished sufficiently, another Marine, not Jones, came up and helped me remove the launcher from my shoulders so that I could get up. When you fired a rocket, or this one, I fired this one, you get down and you squeeze the round off. Now I'm sitting like this, not a to stand, sit, squat, do anything but move and just think neat things. He took it off my shoulder. I got up and I took the present over and laid it into a trench, then threw a hand grenade down the middle of it and blew it up. Then we shouted all clear and everybody came back. I knew then that the only person I could count on was me. I'm sure that Jones learned that some 4 or 5 months earlier. And I'm sure that every single person there learned the same lesson. You're the only one going to get you out of this tour alive. Since 1966, I have in varying degrees maintained this attitude. Till recently, I've been able to trust no one. No one, including myself, wanted to make friends with anybody in combat around them. It seemed as though if you did, either you'd get killed or wounded, or they'd get killed or wounded. So why make friends? Friendships jinx chances for survival. I'll explain more of that later, too. The following weeks in Vietnam were all just more of the same. Isolation, constant fear of dying, distrust and dislike of superiors, which included everyone from Jones on up to the captain, aversions to developing any meaningful relationships with my fellow combatants, and so on and so on and so on. There were no safe spaces and no sure allies over there. Tour of duty was 13 months. We're now up to 2 months, and it's not going to get too much more punishing here. Bear with me. By my 8th week of my tour, I was a seasoned combat Marine. I knew how to take care of myself and my equipment. I knew how to scrounge for my own food, clothing, ammunition, and supplies. I had not yet been wounded. This was to change. I was on a daytime patrol in one of the uglier areas. We used to have, if you can imagine, a circle, and in the center of the circle is the hill where you stayed and slept and stood your watch and things. We had an area that we ordinarily patrolled, and that was relatively safe. When you went out of that certain distance, that was where the Viet Cong had their pleasure. They weren't going to get bothered every day, so they could take the time and set up sophisticated booby traps and punji pits and the like, plan ambushes, build bunkers and the like. The Viet Cong also ruled the countryside all night, every night. It was their home, after all. I was a squad leader now. I had an A gunner who went with me on patrols. He's the one that carried the extra rounds. He was new to the bush, meaning that he'd come probably to the company about a week before we went out on this little operation. I didn't like having a new guy with me. There's a prefacing word to new guy, but I shan't use it. They're awfully clumsy. They're scared, but they're scared for the first time, so they're increasingly more clumsy. I really wasn't in a mood to be patient with that, never was, and I let him know that I didn't like him screwing up, and in short, he was pissing me off, and I told him so. We're out daytime still, and we came to an open spot or a clearing. There's a lot of trees and jungle and all of that stuff, but there's places where there isn't. This happened to be a rice paddy, which also was a gravesite. As we faced the Fulong River that ran by here, and on the left, open for about 30 yards, was nothing, just exposed to the river. Then more tree lines and etc. Rockets, which was my weapon, in the patrol order of march, followed the machine gunner. So there was a machine gunner, and then some distance back was rockets, then my A gunner, and then some people in the rear, riflemen. We came up to the tree line, then one at a time they go racing across this open 30 yards. We didn't stand there in a group holding hands. We were all spread out behind us so as not to give a large target from which to shoot. Wherever two are gathered, so is a good area to sight blade. Machine gunner is here in the tree line just getting ready to take off. My A gunner, who is new to the bush, doesn't know what he's doing, so I'm yelling at him what he should do next, and all my mind is concentrated on what he's not doing right. Finally get him squared away, turn back, and the machine gunner gets ready to go, and he takes off out into the open. I'm counting mentally to myself, and I'm telling the A gunner, get ready to go. Here, we're going next. You've got to follow me. And some superlatives there. Then I took off. Now, I'm still not convinced that he got the word, so I'm about halfway into the clearing, and I look back to make sure that he's ready to take off. He was. So I turn my attention back, and I'm right up next to the machine gunner who had slowed his run across the opening. Very next instant, we got ambushed. There were 7 or 8 rounds came in. I saw the machine gunner get hit in the back. The next thing, I got hit. And the force of the bullet knocked me to the ground. I shouldered the rocket launcher, aimed from where the shots were coming, squeezed the trigger, and once again, nothing happened. There was no pop this time. That meant that the rocket was a dud. It also meant that I needed a new rocket. I was alone in the clearing being shot at. The machine gunner had gone through the middle and into the tree line on the other side of the clearing. My A gunner is in the tree line at the beginning of the clearing. And I don't have any rockets. So I yelled at the A gunner to come up and reload me, give me a new rocket. That was a reasonable request. He refused, just stood there looking at me and refused to come. I was enraged. hopefully you can see that he refused to help me, acted like a coward in battle. His inaction could have killed me, and I fully intended to kick his ass as soon as I got to him, and then reporting for cowardice when I got back to the camp. The shooting stopped. I got up, ran toward the A gunner with some thoughts about what I was going to do to him. And when I got up to him, I saw a terrified, petrified, 18-year-old, out-of-his-wits boy. Had his rifle aimed directly at me. And I knew he would have shot me if I'd threatened him in any way. Trust me. From that moment until a few months ago, this is now January 67, I had difficulty confronting anyone who upset me. That's the end of the input and the little trip. I didn't tell you much about what PTSD is, but more what traumatic incidents are, in my opinion. Hopefully you share some of those. Some things inside of that are considerations of patriotism. Coming back from Vietnam in 1967 and the few years that followed was not a good year to have been in the military fighting for your country, trying to become a hero. In fact, cowardice seems to be an operative word here. The brave people, the real heroes, didn't go. That was talked about. Since that was the case, or that's my opinion of what was the case when I returned from Vietnam, I personally suppressed all those experiences. In fact, if I had my druthers, I would have denied that I was ever in the service. I would have said I was in Southern California or Northern California, rather than confront the verbal and nonverbal abuse of having been a Vietnam veteran. God forbid they knew I was a combat veteran. There's lots of interesting things that I stuffed. That stuffing is putting PTSD in and letting it bubble up. Sometime it's going to pop out. It's rather like a psychological pimple. It's going to come to a head. That's one reason why people may have PTSD. Korea, Second World War, First World War, the men and women who were there were thanked. They were thanked then and there by the whole nation. Not so the Vietnam veteran, despite the welcome home parties we've had recently. Another situation with PTSD, in my opinion, it was a very individualized war. You didn't make friends. Was dangerous to have friends. It had a specific beginning and it had a specific end. 13 months, 397 days, depending on the time of day that the airplane came to take you out, it was that many hours, but it was very specific. So the day the foot touched Vietnam was the day the meter ran, and as long as you could keep it down there and stay alive, you knew you were going to get out at some point. Precisely November 10th, 1967. I got to go like that. That indicates to me a state of hypervigilance 24 hours a day for 13 months. I don't know of any other military action that the United States has ever been in where that was the case. Another interesting thing about the Vietnam conflict was that it was a guerrilla war, start to finish. All 10 years. We'd never fought a guerrilla war before, where women, children, old men, old women, anybody who was a Vietnamese citizen could be a Viet Cong for a day, or just 1 minute. Throw the hand grenade down, and he's a Viet Cong. Clean your shirt the next day, and he's a Vietnamese citizen. There's other aspects to guerrilla warfare that were a part of Vietnam that I don't believe was a part of any other military conflict. So that made Vietnam a little more special. There was no group camaraderie. There was instead jealousy. You were jealous of the new guy because he didn't know the bad data you got yet. You were jealous of the guy who had been there one day before you because he was going to go home before you. Interesting. I tried to indicate to you that once you step your foot down in Vietnam, your tour of duty begins. But that is also the time your war starts. There were, as you remember, rocket attacks in Da Nang. They could shoot at you from 10 miles out. Mines, booby traps, punji sticks, ambushes, the North Vietnamese Army, deserters, other advisors, non-stop, 24 hours a day for 13 months. 12 months for the Army. New guys were dangerous. That's why you didn't associate with them. They'd trip, they'd stand like I did the first time. Somebody standing up draws the attention of the person firing the weapon. So there's going to be more bullets going in the direction of the new guy. And if you're near the new guy, you're at greater risk. Clumsy. They'd trip the fish wire, hand grenade booby traps. They'd step in the punji pits. That stops a lot of things. You got to sit and tend and help them. In the cases of larger mines and hand grenades, you could get hit by some of the stuff that didn't hit him. And you go down just like anybody else. So new guys were dangerous. So also were short timers. That was anybody who had less than about 30 days to go. It was my experience that short timing, time before you get to go, is getting shorter and shorter, kicked in about 3 months before rotation. Things that kick in are refusals to go out on patrols, then having to insist that a short timer go out on a patrol because you can't go out with 10 men. You'd rather have 11 with you. Well, you run the risk of the guy shooting you, putting a hand grenade in a bush next to where you're standing and saying, oh, geez, he hit a booby trap, when in fact he fragged you, which is the term that got to be popular later. So was the activity later. Short timers were dangerous also because they were intelligently as afraid as the new guy. So they would do absolutely outrageous things to keep themselves from getting hurt. And activity that wasn't the best activity you could do put everyone at risk. So now we've got pole marks on new guys and we got pole marks on short timers. You don't trust anybody, so you're just there by yourself in your little war. I think by the examples of my two fond experiences with the rocket launcher, you can tell how good my equipment was. The rockets had 1955 printed on them. That's when they were made. I could go on and on about the M16 rifle, which I got about 7 months into my tour, but we all know what that fine weapon did for our people. Till we had court-martial orders that our rifles would work, that they would not jam or you would be in a jam. So the weapon didn't get any bigger, the noise just got a lot quieter. Now you take a person like that and let me give you something I didn't write down. On November 10th, I was on a patrol, 1967. That afternoon, I was on a plane for El Toro, Southern California. When the plane landed, I was on a 20-day leave in the United States. There is no chill-down period. From either killing or being killed in the morning to going out to dinner with my wife in one 24-hour period seemed a little unfair to my ex-wife. And it was. I guess lastly, on a remark about PTSD, give you something that most Marines I know hold near and dear. Big boys don't cry. So of course they don't have PTSD. That's for sissies. They were men, not the case. I mentioned that I'd run around with that data and experiences, which quite frankly and openly and honestly I've never talked to anybody about before today in any gathering of more than two or three people, so thanks for bearing with me. I want to tell you about some of the quality of help that's around, as I know it, from the Veterans Administration Mental Health and Rehabilitation System. I'm confident that you're going to conclude, as I have, that this is representative of what not to do. In 1986, in August, I was having a particularly difficult time with a combination of some personal setbacks. Setbacks one at a time are okay to handle as long as you're stuffing problems and stuffing upsets and you're not worried about confronting anyone, so you just avoid the confrontation at all and all the other little precious tools I had. Well, I got hit back to back and that upset me. And I knew I needed to get some help, but I didn't know where to turn. So I called the Veterans Administration in Menlo Park, just down the street. It is, by the way, nationally acclaimed as the center for PTSD treatment. At least that's my opinion of its lofty title. I'll poll you later to see if you agree with that. After fighting on the phone for a little bit and being transferred and put on hold and speaking to people that didn't speak my native language and a few other things, I finally got an appointment with a counselor. Went down and talked to him for about an hour and a half. Talked at him for an hour and a half. And at the end of that hour and a half, I just kind of wandered away. There was nothing to it. In fact, I was more upset when I left than when I'd first arrived. So, being the brave United States Marine Corps combat veteran, I sent him a letter and said I wasn't coming back. Rather than phone him and tell him that or anything else. And that was the end of it. I just picked up my own stuff and tried to cope as I could. About 3 months later, the same counselor, actually he was a is a respected therapist in that group of the VA, particularly within the post-traumatic stress disorder legion. He called me up and he said, we're going to have a Thursday evening group meeting once a week, and it's going to go on for some time, but I'm sure you'll get a lot out of it because it's all combat experience Vietnam vets, and we know you are. What do you think? And I said, oh, sure, I'd be happy to meet some friends. I mean, I didn't make many friends, especially vets. I didn't have any when I was there, so who was I to keep up with? Although this group, which met every week for an hour and a half in Menlo Park, in the core building of Mecca, with two therapists, was supposed to be for combat veterans. Of the 11 people that were in the group, only three of them were combat experienced. This was not as advertised, but I stayed, much to my chagrin. Here is an example of the quality of help I received. This is very shortly before I quit going there, some year and something of Thursday evening meetings of being upset. Two of the guys were in a minor disagreement right at the beginning of the meeting. One of them, combat experienced, wanted to keep things centered on Vietnam issues and situations. You know, this about me. This is when I was shot at, or this is when I saw my best friend blown up, or whatever. But at least let's keep it focused on Vietnam. The other guy, who was not combat experienced, wanted to deal with present time issues. I'm upset now, I'm about to lose my job, and my car won't start, and I need new tires. This, it's true. If I could make it up, I'd write a book. Well, what the therapists did, which was not atypical, which was pretty common, whenever something was going awry in the group, they'd call on me. They'd punch one of my buttons, and I'd take off for about 45 minutes and make it real interesting, and then that'd fill up the hour that they needed, and they could send everybody home. So they punched my talk button, and I obliged with the following. This is another one of the cruelties of the Vietnam conflict. They gave people rest and recuperation, which was called R&R. You got to go leave your personal war for from 5 to 7 days. The 7 day R&Rs were to Australia and to Honolulu, Hawaii. I chose Honolulu to go to. Now I'm 7 months in, probably 80 patrols, maybe 4 major operations. And I decided I'd go see my wife. I'm telling the group this. It was kind of like a monologue like I'm doing now. I'm telling the group that I told my wife I was absolutely unaffected by Vietnam. It was a walk in the park. I'm 5 years older than she. She needn't worry about me. I'm worried about her. I'll be home right after the close of business. No, it isn't tough. It's just it's a cakewalk. I told the group how upsetting and difficult that was for me to face in 1987. The pictures that came up that go across those prior 7 months are still pretty stimulating, and it probably wouldn't serve anything if I shared them with you, so I'll just let you kind of imagine some of them and fill in the blanks. Anyhow, I cried a long time toward the end of my little visit there in the group in Menlo Park. As a matter of fact, in Menlo Park in 1988, I was in Honolulu in 1967, physically and mentally there. After I dried up my tears, the lead therapist, with no acknowledgement of me or my mental condition or my current state, nor a thank you, nor any other acknowledgement, turned to the group and said, "Well, we're just about out of time now, but before we break up, I want to make sure that that upset we had before doesn't affect the group. We're all going to be here next week, aren't we?" That was Thursday night. The group adjourned. Didn't seem to be any reason not to meet next Thursday. I went home, turned off the lights, got on the airplane coming from Hawaii to Vietnam, and got off that plane the following Sunday night. I didn't leave my apartment to eat, buy new cigarettes or anything. It was real appreciated how they took care of me in the mecca of PTSD. The only thing that did come out that was of any meaningful, sustaining, and currently ongoing joy was that I met Peter Van Engelen at one of the VA meetings. We became fast friends. He and I are both combat experienced. We share a sixth sense affinity that goes beyond just friendships or liking the cut of his suit. Through Peter, I met Gerald and Rosamund French, Dr. Gerbode, his wife, family members, and friends. I began to learn of facilitation, viewing, and so forth. Talking to Peter and Gerald, I told them I was interested in what was going on because it sure sounded a little better than what I'd been getting at the hands of the qualified. God. Well, the way I got into things was, Gerald says, "Hey, have a look at the communication course." I said, "I can communicate." He said, "Well, have a look anyhow." So Peter and I took the course together. I began the communication course more out of the pleasure of Peter's company than thinking I was going to get anything meaningful out of it. What I did get out of it was an ability to communicate my feelings, at least, which, just as an aside, liberated about $5,000 or $6,000 in money I wouldn't have asked for that was due me in commissions and the like. So that more than paid for that course. Thank you for that. Then I learned about facilitation. Of it, not about it. Peter had been viewing with Gerald. And I expressed an interest in that as well. I mean, the communication course paid for itself. Maybe I could get some help with my post-traumatic stress disorder problems, my little traumas and upsets. At one of Dr. Gerbode's Sunday afternoon get-togethers at his home, I met another splendid individual, Tom Kaczynski. Still later in time, Gerald let me know that there might be a chance that Tom could be a facilitator, I the viewer, and I leapt at the chance. This brings us right just before Christmas, and that's when I began viewing. I'm currently working with Gerald as my facilitator. I have no idea how long I've been in viewing so far. Perhaps 15 hours, certainly no more. Some of the effects for me, I now sleep through most nights, something I didn't do and can now do. I remember my dreams and their colors, and I've had other private victories. For instance, I can sing the Star Spangled Banner start to finish without choking. I know I have more work to do. I look forward to confronting other incidents that are within the contents of my interview and the pictures that pop up that were below the first level of pimple. I want to get back to being the business of me again. I look forward to doing that. All this has to do, from my point of view, with traumatic incident reduction. And I feel that traumatic incident reduction, as it's practiced here at the Institute, and as I've experienced, works for PTSD victims. And it applies to any group of troubled, less able people. There'll be more on that from Mr. Van Engelen's workshop tomorrow, particularly focused at our comrades. Hope you've enjoyed listening to me as much as I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for your attention.
Sarge said something this morning about the fact that working with somebody successfully is the most pleasurable thing you can possibly do, and that the pleasure that's experienced by the person you're working with is exceeded only by the pleasure that you experience in successfully helping. And I know that Hazel and Ann and most of the people in this room have had that experience many, many times, and it's very rewarding.